This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martirano. We're here on Saturdays at this time, and we're talking about substance abuse, the disease of addiction, and a lot of issues surrounding that. Topic, obviously, much in the news. We have a special kind of program, I think, today in that we're going to focus in on one group that may be particularly susceptible to the stresses of, you know, modern life and certainly the problems with substance abuse, but a much broader look at the teenage situation regarding their overall mental health. You know, 40 years ago, the rock band The Who sang about a teenage wasteland. That may be truer today than ever. We've seen, you know, alarming numbers about the rise in adolescent suicide rates that are just one indicator of a crisis that, I mean, that may be the word for this, a full-blown mental health crisis among American teenagers. To take a look at that, a deep look at that, we are pleased to have with us Caroline Fenkel, who is a psychotherapist. Caroline specializes in treating substance abuse issues and mental health, the mental health of adolescents. In that capacity, she works with the Newport Academy, and she is executive director of the Centers for Families in Malvern, about which more we will find out later. So we welcome Caroline to the program. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to find out all about Newport Academy and certainly the Center for Families in Malvern, because it's some interesting work that's being done there. But I'd like to get your take on my characterization of a mental health crisis among young people in this country. Is that overstating it?
It's not overstating it, actually. What we're finding more and more with teenagers is that the school and education component of what it is that they're dealing with in high school, with the drop in rates of college admissions, with the incredible amount of pressure that oftentimes their parents are putting on them to be successful, that it really becomes kind of a pressure cooker for them to be functioning in school. And so that oftentimes leads to anxiety, it leads to depression, it leads to isolation, and we're actually seeing higher and higher rates of suicide among adolescents at this point.
It is, if my research is correct here, the third leading cause of death among people between the ages of like 10 and 24. Is that correct?
I believe that is true. And it's pretty scary because it's been going up and up, specifically in the last 10 years. It's increasing and increasing. And there's a lot of theories around why it is increasing and what are the causes that are leading to that increase. Which we can get a little bit more into.
Yeah, there's something like almost 5,000 deaths a year from suicide among this group.
It's really quite scary, and it's interesting because we're not talking too much about it in the media. We're talking a lot more about the opiate epidemic and how that's killing a lot of people. We're also talking a lot about school shootings, which are, you know, both of those things are really related to these mental health issues that kids are facing, and the suicidal ideation oftentimes can sometimes lead to this addiction opiate epidemic. It can also lead to the school shootings, which we've seen time and time again.
Yeah, we're gonna get as deep as we can in the time allowed to take a look at some of the causes for this. But tell us a little bit about Newport Academy and the Center for Families.
Yeah, so Newport Academy is a series of healing centers for teenagers, all evidence-based and really focused in on the family, as well as holistic types of therapies, such as adventure therapy, mixed martial arts, yoga, meditation, strong kind of focus on mindfulness. The idea with Newport Academy is a residential treatment program that teenagers go to. There's a site in Connecticut and a site in California. And it essentially is a healing environment for teenagers to go to, similar to the retreat for adults. And it's a way for them to kind of get away from the pressures of school, get away from the pressures of their family, and be able to go into a setting where they can really focus on themselves and how to heal themselves. And a lot of, you know, the teenagers that end up there typically are suffering from things such as mental health disorder, anxiety, depression that's leading to function decreases in functionality, so dropping grades, isolation, not seeing friends, and then there's the substance users who usually externalize their problems. So those are the kids that are partying every weekend or drinking before school or smoking pot daily, and all the way up to some kids that have some eating disorder problems. Mm-hmm. So basically, Newport can treat all three problems, which is really nice because it's a place where you'll have a kid who's cutting themselves next to a kid who's struggling with a marijuana addiction, next to a kid who's struggling with an eating disorder, and instead of focusing on the symptoms, instead they're focusing on the underlying issues that kind of led to these symptoms. So, you know, the conversation switches from, you know, I had a 2-foot bong. Well, I had a 4-foot bong, all the way to, well, this is what it was like for me when my parents would fight. So it's really quite nice because it's a good milieu of kids that are all just struggling, and they're able to really talk more about the underlying issues that they're struggling with.
And where does the Center for Families fit into this?
Yeah, so the Center for Families is a sister program to Newport Academy. It was founded by Jameson Monroe, who founded also Newport Academy, and kind of in collaboration with me and Jameson, we were able to come up with an idea and a vision for a place that could be more of a center for, like more of a community center for anything that somebody is struggling with. So we have programming at Center for Families in Malvern. Anything from free peer parent support groups or free yoga classes all the way up to a partial hospitalization program where kids are here from 9:30 in the morning until 9 p.m. at night. So we kind of provide all levels of care, and we're able to really move with the needs of the community. So, for example, we got a lot of requests to have a refuge recovery meeting. Refuge recovery is a Buddhist take on the 12 steps. So anybody who kind of shies away from a 12-step program and has a drug or alcohol problem, and they're more interested in the Buddhist kind of way of life, in a sense, you know, we were able to start a refuge recovery meeting, which meets here at Center for Families on Monday nights from 7 to 8. And there's about now like 20 to 30 people who come to that meeting, which is pretty neat. So what's kind of cool about the Center for Families is that unlike a lot of other programs that are in the area that are more prescriptive and more like this is what we do and this is what we don't do, we really try and listen to the needs of the community and then provide programming for that. So we continued to hear a need for a partial hospitalization that focused on mental health and substance abuse. So we got licensed for both substance abuse and for mental health and started providing a partial hospitalization program where we have a day school, and then we also have an IOP, an intensive outpatient program. So we also kept on hearing the needs for peer parent support groups, that parents really aren't getting enough support when their child is struggling. And so we created this peer parent support group. And, you know, essentially we're able to provide the community with whatever it is that they need and essentially be able to have assessments for teens. Like if a parent has no idea what's going on with their teenager, we bring them in for a 2-hour comprehensive assessment, then we're able to provide referrals and next steps for them as well. So we're really lucky in the sense that we have 8,500 square feet in this big building in Malvern, and we're able to provide a lot of different programming, art therapy once a week, music therapy. We have art and music therapy actually for both adults, like the parents, and also for the teens. So that's really neat, too. So then they can kind of bond over that, you know, when they leave here.
Well, you know, what's interesting in hearing you describe your work and certainly the Center for Families, we know that with regard to substance abuse, the rule of thumb is that this is a disease of the family. Is that truer in some sense when we're talking about young people who are having issues with drugs or alcohol?
Yeah, absolutely. So what all the research actually shows us, and there's a plethora of research that shows us that parent participation in treatment is the single largest indicator for positive outcomes. So what that means is that the more often that parents attend family therapy, the more often that parents attend their own personal individual therapy, the more often that they get their own support and peer parent support groups, the quicker and the better that their child is going to get. Mm-hmm. So it's quite fascinating to kind of dive into and roll up your sleeves into that research. And I'm kind of a research geek. I'm currently in a doctorate program at University of Pennsylvania, and I was lucky enough to be able to put together a research proposal for looking at peer parent support groups and what kind of happens to parents once they are able to get their own help, and what happens to teenagers when they get their own help. And a lot of that is based off of the modeling behavior. So the teenager that says, like, I don't want to go to therapy, I'm not going to go to therapy, you know, and then mm-hmm. if the parent just looks at them and goes, well, you know what, I'm getting my own therapy because I need to address my own role and I need to reflect on my own parenting style and figure out how we can help this family, suddenly the conversation really shifts.
Sure.
Suddenly the teenager's a lot more willing to show up to therapy.
Well, I can't think of two groups more likely to need something like this than parents and teenagers, who seem like two groups only separated by a common language. And parents and teenagers don't really talk to each other. They talk sort of at each other or across each other. Is that the case?
Yeah, or they don't talk to each other at all.
At all, yeah.
You know, so we typically have kids that come in and, you know, parents are on their phones in the waiting room and the kid is on their phone in the waiting room, and they're not really talking or communicating to one another whatsoever. They're speaking two completely different languages, specifically around technology. They're speaking two completely different languages when it comes to schoolwork as well. And definitely trying to get them on the same page is a huge part. Parents have completely different expectations of their teens than what the teens think that they have. And because of the fact that they're just not communicating effectively, they're unable to really get onto the same page, which is what leads to a lot of tension in the household.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Caroline Fenkel is our guest. Caroline is a psychotherapist. She specializes in treating mental health and substance abuse issues regarding adolescents. She is the executive director of Centers for Families in Malvern. She's a psychotherapist also working with the Newport Academy. Center for Families is an outgrowth of the Newport Academy. Caroline, let's get back to this issue of being a teenager, the difficulties involved in that. I think Andy Hardy was the last person who had a happy and carefree teenage years. Now we have different circumstances. Two things I want to address in this segment here. One is, what are the particular and unique stressors that affect young people today, and probably many, many of them. But before you get to that, how do parents distinguish between your sort of garden variety teenage angst, difficulties, surliness, whatever, and potential problems? Because if, you know, a family is on the lookout for this, as they should be, how do they make that distinction?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, the idea around what is today this generation's problems and how are they related, I think is kind of twofold. So the first one is really just this idea that the traditional academic setting oftentimes does not work for all kids, right? And for a lot of kids, it's like shoving a round peg into a square hole. And what we know is that teenagers do really well when they can specialize in something that they're really interested in. And the problem that we're up against with today's academic society is the idea that they need to either, you know, that they need to go to these four core curriculum classes. So, you know, science, history, math, and English, and usually some type of a language. And what that leaves room out for is that the artists and the poets and the writers and the journalists of today really do not get any kind of time during the day to focus on what it is that they love. this is all part of a bigger discussion around the Industrial Revolution, really kind of pushing the academic, the school system to more focus on creating a workforce and creating a middle class. Mm-hmm. And so what they said was, we're going to have these four different, core curriculum, and everybody has to go through them, and everybody has to do well. And now suddenly, instead of, getting done high school and being 18 and going to college and being able to specialize in college in some type of a major, we're now shoving them into core curriculum classes in college. So it's not until they're 21 years old or 20 years old that they can start taking electives their junior and senior year in college. And quite frankly, it's really inappropriate, because the reality is that many kids do not do well in every single one of those subjects. And the idea that they need to do well is just kind of a fantasy, specifically for kids that are, outside of the bell curve and that don't learn in that way. So kids that have different learning disorders, kids that have different issues, and who really would rather specialize in music and in art and things like that, really just kind of fall through the cracks. And we see that a lot here at Center for Families, and we see these kind of alternative kids that just are not in any way, shape, or form being supported by the traditional academic setting.
One of the things I hear from doing these interviews, certainly across the age spectrum, but particularly with young people, is this sense that they don't fit anywhere. Part of being a teenager is finding out, where you fit. Is that the major cause of their confusion and depression and suicidal thoughts, that they just don't fit anywhere?
So there's that, right? That's like a big part of it. And a lot of that can be attributed to the traditional academic setting. That a lot of these kids don't fit into the traditional academic setting. And there are kids that do really, really well at math and fail history and English. Well, why is that fair, right? Like, why can't they take more math classes then? And why can they slow down on the history and the English? And there's just no room for that at all in any public school, in any private schools. And then they're being pushed and told that they have to get all A's in every subject in order to get into college. So now they're in college and they're like, yes, I can just focus on math. Well, guess what? No, you can't. You have to take Literature 101. You have to take English 101. So it's like, it's pretty much a lose-lose situation for kids who learn differently, who want to specialize in something early on, who have a passion early on, and then that passion gets dampened. And that's the whole idea of the Industrial Revolution, of them kind of being forced into this, the factories.
Yeah, mass. Right?
Those are the kids that get forced into the factories.
So how do parents talk to kids about this? You certainly can't sit your kid down and say, don't worry about the D. Focus on the A you got. How do parents talk to children, young people, about that situation you just described?
Yeah, so the big part about this is having parents really encourage and motivate kids to get into extracurricular activities. So they're really into sports, making sure that they have access to sports. If they're really into art, making sure that they get into some kind of an art club. And even enrolling them into a bunch of different places in the area. Art clubs usually only meet once a week. So what else could they do towards their artistic ability that are in the area that they're able to do? And obviously those oftentimes, take resources and money, and sometimes they can't necessarily get them into something like that. So that's kind of where the societal barrier stands in the way.
Yeah, our kids.
But parents definitely need to be encouraging them to do as much as they can outside of the school setting.
Mm-hmm. Are kids forthcoming in describing what they want or to their parents?
Sometimes. Typically, honestly, at least the kids that end up in my office, parents don't really ask them what they like to do. They just kind of look at their grades and say, you really need to be doing better in history. And that's about it. And that's as far as it goes. In the assessment that we do here, one of the big questions is, what do you want to be when you grow up? And sometimes kids have a passion and know what it is that they want to do. They want to be a veterinarian. They want to, be an artist. They want to be a journalist. But, oftentimes parents don't necessarily talk to them about that. Sometimes because parents themselves have ended up in careers that they never really wanted.
Exactly. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're going to rejoin our guest, Caroline Finkel, straight ahead to talk more about adolescents and the problems they're facing in this day and age. I want to remind you, though, as I do every week, that the whole thing is brought to you by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. And again, I remind you, as I do every week, that, they pay the freight here, but they're really not selling anything but information. They want this program to be informational regarding substance abuse and whatever emotional issues that result. Because of that, I give you the phone number, and I hope that you never have to use it. But if you want some answers to questions, no matter what they might be, regarding this issue, Retreat, they're terrific people. They have a wonderful reputation, and they will answer your questions. They will do that. 855-859-8808 is how to reach them. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, 855-859-8808. Caroline Finkel, a psychotherapist dealing with adolescents, is our guest on the telephone. Caroline, let's talk about some of the particularly unique stress factors that are contributing to what looks like a mental health crisis among teenagers in this country. What role has technology played in making things either better or worse for young people?
Yeah, so the big theory as to why it is that the mental health crisis is continuing to raise and why suicide is continuing to raise among this population in the past 10 years has a lot to do with technology. And there's been some research to substantiate it and some research to kind of go against it a little bit. So what we know is this. We know that these phones that these kids have are actually now their social sphere. And that has radically changed, right? So when I was in high school, my social sphere was getting out of the house as much as I could, going to friends' houses, going to house parties. Parents were away. We would go there and party. We would go over to friends' houses and watch movies when there wasn't a party. We would go to the mall and hang out. I went to the King of Prussia Mall last Saturday night. There were no teenagers.
Yeah. By the way, Caroline, you're not very old at all. So you're talking about a situation that's not the 100 years
that's
ago.
That's the thing is that it's That's exactly it. That's what makes it unique is that it's rapidly changed. It changed almost overnight. I have parents of kids that are 22, 23, 24, and that say that their 14-year-old and their 15-year-old and their 16-year-old respond and react very, very differently. So in just a few short years, what we're finding is that instead of the focus being, I want to get out of the house, I want to get out of the house, I want to get out of the house, I want to go and see my friends face to face, the kids that I treat now, the parents are begging them to get out of the house. They would rather lay in bed, watch Netflix and Snapchat. It's all that matters to them.
The combination of smartphones and social media is a revolution that happened, practically overnight. If you are in your early 30s, you might have been lucky enough to just miss that. My children are. They didn't have smartphones when they were in high school. And now I understand that the average age for someone having a phone is like 10 or 11. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, so what we're finding more and more is that around 5th grade, 6th grade, kids are having their phones. I have 13 nieces and nephews. A large majority of them are between, they're between 8 and 14. And almost all of them have Instagram accounts. They all follow me and I follow them. It's hilarious. I mean, they're 9 and 10 years old with Instagram accounts. It's wild. And they all have Snapchat accounts. And, you know, I mean, I think that that early kind of exposure to social media can definitely be both a challenge, but at the same time, we really can't negate the fact that there are positives to this, right? So what happens is that teenagers very much feel connected on their phones. So while parents, it's this paradox, right? While parents perceive these phones to be isolating and depression-inducing, teenagers find them to be a place of happiness, a place of soothing, and they also find them to be a place of connection. It's funny, there's an application called House Party, and what you do is you go on it, and there's like 20 people that can all be on the same screen. and they all look at each other. It's like FaceTime, and they're all chatting with one another and starting side conversations and all that. And it's pretty wild, because when I used to be a kid, I would go to IRL, that's what they call it, in real life, an IRL house party, an in real life house party, right, where I would see everybody face to face. And these days, it's just very different. They're in their pajamas, they're at home.
Well, kids,
and, almost every parent that I talk to talks about trying to encourage their kids to get out of the house, out of the house, and out of the house.
Yeah. Well, there's, it's fascinating from a number of angles. One of the things that strikes me about this connectivity that kids have today is that you mentioned when we were chatting the other day about the fact that they have an audience, and that's a kind of brand new thing. My impression, though, is that there's no respite from being under peer pressure when you are connected like this because of technology. You know, before social media, before smartphones, kids went to school, went to parties, did everything you just described in your experience, and it was in that context they had to be judged. They had to fit in. They had to figure out what their peers were expecting and what they were expecting. But you could go home, and you could be just a kid at home, and you know, and you didn't have to worry about how you looked or whether you were smart or funny or any of that. They don't have that ability anymore. They are constantly called upon to, I guess, perform. Is that healthy?
Yeah, I mean, that's yes and no, right? So I have a lot of kids, for example, who turn their phones off at 11 p.m. or who try and leave their phones downstairs and try to get kind of a respite from their phone. So there's some truth to that, but you know, even if we were to look back, 30 years ago, where kids would use house phones, right? And they'd be on the phone all night. All night long, they would be on the phone with their friends and hanging up and adding people into the phone and all that. So there is something to be said for the 24/7 nature of it, and I do think that that is an important component of it. But I don't think that that's the most harmful component. The most harmful component of the social media comes down to the bullying, the cyberbullying that happens on there.
What about sexting?
So sexting is definitely a problem. It's fascinating these days with sexting. It's in the bell curve. Sending photos back and forth to kids doing that whole thing. It is officially within the bell curve, in the sense that that's what almost every kid is doing. There are some kids that aren't doing it, obviously. But I will say that it is definitely rampant. But even with that, right, then comes blackmail and then comes cyberbullying. And cyberbullying is kind of in the texting realm of things, mm-hmm. which is really, really detrimental.
How realistic is it to expect parents to be able to control their kids' use of phones and social media?
So that's where things get kind of really individualized, in the sense that it really depends on the kid. So if there is a really big problem, for example, I've treated some kids that have social media addiction where they're talking to strangers, right? And they don't know how old these strangers are. They don't know what they're sending these strangers. They don't know what the strangers are sending them. That's really grounds for an intervention of a parent, in the sense that they really do need to take control of the situation. Kids that are constantly on their phones, that are sitting in the car with the parents and are on their phones and Snapchatting and laughing into their phones, and their parents don't feel connected to them, that's kind of less of an intervention that parents can really do in that moment. The real thing that the parents should be doing is putting down their own phone and perhaps setting up a technology-free night where everybody puts their phones together and they all just interact with one another and say that they're not going to touch their phone for the next 3 hours. So there's like easy interventions for that, and then there's of course the interventions that might be more intense for more risk-taking behavior.
Do you recommend that parents, spy is not the right word, but look into what's going on their kids' Snapchat accounts and all of that, or is there a zone of privacy there that has to be
I do not recommend it. And ever since iCloud came out, and it's very interesting because I've been doing this for a while now, and once iCloud kind of came out, what happened was is that all these parents had iPads, right? iPads are really geared towards the adult population. And these kids had their phones. And so what happens is that all of their text messages started going to their parents' iPads because of iCloud linking them up. And I would have parents come in to me with iPads and just showing me all the conversations that their kids were having. Well, guess what? These kids were lying. So, like, for example, we had a kid who was texting his friend and was like, I'm at this huge house party, and I just dropped acid, and it's insane, and I can't believe it, and it's amazing. And the parent knew that the kid was downstairs watching movies, right? Because she could go downstairs and see that the kid was watching movies. So he was just lying. And, you know, any parent who might not know, let's just pretend that kid was at his friend's house watching movies, you know, that parent would have freaked out, right? And said, like, oh my God, he's at a party. Where is he? I need to find him. I need to call the police. But in reality, that's not what was happening. So sometimes kids are lying and parents are reading them and taking them as truth.
Finally here in a couple of seconds before we take another break, do you recommend that parents use the technology available to track the whereabouts of their teenagers?
No. I mean, I think that if we were to... If when you were growing up and when I was growing up, my parents were able to track me, it would be a serious breach of privacy. The thing to recognize is that these kids are trying to go from dependence to independence, and we have to really empower them to do that and allow them to have that advocacy and, you know, use the idea of, like, innocent until proven guilty.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We've been having a terrific conversation about the state of teenagers. Who are undergoing some remarkable changes in their life and technology that's changed all of that, and corresponding problems regarding substance abuse and mental health. The suicide rate among that group is tragically high and getting higher. Caroline Finkel has been with us. She is a psychotherapist with Newport Academy, and she is the executive director of their Center for Families in Malvern. She specializes in treating teenagers in crisis. Caroline, in the final segment, you'll take a look at the movement towards legalizing recreational marijuana. What impact has that movement had on teenagers with regard to how they think and they're experimenting with the substances?
Yeah. So I think that what's difficult around this marijuana situation is the idea that from a public health standpoint, it makes sense to legalize marijuana, because what we know is that marijuana is one of the least amount of toxic intoxicants, right? So being intoxicant is not going to go away. And what we know is that marijuana is safer than alcohol, and we know that it's safer than illicit drugs. But unfortunately, when it comes specifically to teenagers, the research shows us that their IQ points actually drop by eight IQ points, which I don't know how much you know about IQ, but that's a significant amount.
Yeah, sure it is.
So what we know is that chronic exposure to marijuana in adolescents, specifically between 14 and 18, will significantly damage their prefrontal cortex along with their executive functioning, along with their memory. So the problem that we're up against is that as this legalization for marijuana movement goes on, kids then get the message that it's safe. Which is really interesting, because what I typically have is I have kids in my office saying, well, tell me this, Caroline, you know, if marijuana is so bad for you, like, why is the government making it legal? You know, and my answer is always, well, you're making the assumption that the government's looking out for your best interest, which they're not, right? They're in $13 trillion of debt, and they're trying to make up for it. And the way to do that is to tax a substance that everybody is dealing and using, and why not make sure that they get their piece of the pie of that? And, you know, then I go into a discussion around alcohol. Alcohol is legal, right? And, you know, do you drink every single day or drink your face off? No, you know, you don't. Even though it's legal, it is not something that you're going to do, because there's a lot of public, you know, there's a lot of kind of PSAs that are out there around what alcohol can do to teenagers. And so, you know, we really kind of have to get a grasp on the message that's being sent to teenagers around marijuana. And the issue that we're up against is just that the media is making it out to be completely safe, which for adults, that might be true. But when it comes to teenagers, it's far from safe.
When it comes to teenagers, it is particularly not safe because they, as you know, they are in this go mode. They haven't developed the capacity to measure the cause and effect equation.
Right. There's a level of invincibility, right? They feel like they're invincible. They can kind of get through anything. And the prefrontal cortex, I always like to say the cake isn't fully baked yet, right?
Yeah. And
so this is the idea that you add drugs into it and they're going to make impulsive decisions.
They're never going to be able to, before the fact, measure what might happen if I do this. They don't think that way, do they?
Correct.
All right. So in the couple of minutes we have left, again, for parents that are dealing with issues that are, you know, serious and problematic and are looking for help, they're in one set of circumstances. But what about the parents who are worried about this? They observe their teenagers. They try to talk to them. Are there signs they can look for, red flags? What might a couple of those be?
So I think that the big red flags are isolation, dropping grades, any kind of lack of finding fun in things, right? So if when they were 12 and 13, they loved to go to soccer camp, and now they're 14 and 15, and they don't want to go to soccer camp, what does that mean? So any kind of finding lack of fun in things that they typically find fun can oftentimes be a red flag. Any kind of struggle with peers, so if they're coming home and they're crying about some issues that they're having with peers, oftentimes that's a good kind of red flag. While that's normal, it's definitely something that you want to get assessed. And, you know, the truth is that, you know, most parents have a really gut reaction to whether or not their kids are okay. And if at any point in time they think that their kid is not okay, we're so lucky in the United States because we're able to have these really great resources of going and being able to get help from a professional that would know whether or not your teen's turmoil is in the bell curve or if it's outside of the bell curve and they need more help and more support.
What about their friends? Is it important for parents to know who their children are friends with?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the more the parents are involved with their teen and the more that they can communicate with them, the better. So I always say that from 0 to 7, parents are their child's controller, right? They're controlling them. They're telling them, they're pulling them back from the street. They're telling them what to eat, when to go to bed. From 7 to 14, they're their child's guider. They're guiding them, saying you should be eating veggies, not this, but, you know, you should look both ways when you cross the street. And that from 14 on, they're their child's consultant. And the child should come to them and feel comfortable enough to come to them. They should be able to bounce some things off of them and then either take their advice or not take their advice. And parents can't take personally whether or not they take their advice. But essentially, from 14 on, your parenting is pretty limited. And so to be able to have a relationship with your child where they're able to bounce ideas off of you and tell you who they're going to go hang out with, et cetera, that's the goal. It's for them to be able to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Caroline, thanks so much. It's a big, big topic. It's a very important one. We've sort of just touched upon these things. I hope we can have you back on the program real soon. Caroline Fenkel is the Executive Director of Centers for Families in Malvern. You can go on their website if you want more information about that. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week, hopefully. Here on Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.